It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It's a better, shorter version of Blood Over Brighthaven. In this essay, it's very much like, hey, the existence of Utopia is not the point. How much responsibility does a member of society have for the collective ills and woes of it?
I will plant my flag in one way. Now, we've attacked the French a lot vis-a-vis Monte Cristo.
Of course.
Canada, you're next. I think we learned Canada sucks. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Tutor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
We are doing an essay discussion breakdown today. We've covered Le Guin a couple times with an essay and two of her books. It seems like her novels are big thought experiments and are heavy on the themes. And that can work for people if they like the themes of the book. And sometimes it's less focused on the narrative. Some people like the narrative. But what we found is that the essays have a lot more to break down and talk about. Like this 5-page essay we're about to talk about, which is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. It is an essay that she wrote in 1973. It is her most famous and popular one, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And this is the one that gets referred to. It's in her, I believe this is also in that book, The Language of the Night, if I'm correct.
I believe you're right.
It's a book full of her essays that she's done. And yeah, so we're going to talk about this essay. It's 5 pages long. We'll have it in the description below if you want to read it in full. We'll give the context, and this will be more of a discussion one like all of our essay breakdowns are.
No real spoiler warning. I guess technically it's a short story, but very much closer to essay. So I don't think there's spoilers to have. You don't have to read it. You could read it afterward. But getting into it.
Yes.
What is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas about, Austin?
It's about Salem, Oregon.
Yes, kind of. Kind of true. That is where Omelas comes from.
Well, yeah, just a neat factoid I found when looking into this was the word Omelas. People that maybe haven't heard of the essay are going, what is Omelas? Well, it's this fictional town, this fictional city that is created, or society that's created in order to give this thought experiment, which we'll get into. But the term Omelas, it's just this place that's fictional, but comes from, if you read it backwards, it's Salem space O. Like Salem, yeah. Salem, Oregon.
Which also sounds, I think it was a happy accident, but not really deliberately, but it sounds like home at last.
Oh.
In kind of like a final utopia, like, home at last, home at last.
Yes, but. Yes. Now, what the essay is about, what the essay is about is it sets up this thought experiment where imagine this society, this type of utopia where everybody's full of joy and it's happiness. Everybody's happy. And there's this very good quote, which we'll go back to. So just broad thing, then we'll get into the quotes and stuff. But imagine this utopia where everybody is happy, everybody is joyful, except zoom in into the society for a second. Zoom into this one room, and I'm going to show you why this society is prospering. There's one person in this room, a child, who, as the child's described, they look 8, but they're really 12. They're that malnourished. They are tortured. They are all the worst things that could be happening to a child. They are suffering. And the only rule of this society is that all the joy and all the prosperity of Omelas can exist so long as this child suffers. And you can't change anything. You can't do anything. The child's going to suffer. If you do change stuff, it's going to change the happiness of society. So if you want everybody to exist in this utopia, you have to let that child suffer. And
everyone also knows this is not a secret kept. It's taught to children when they're a little older, but ultimately everyone knows and is aware of this child. Some have seen the child and walked in on this child being tortured, and others just know in the background or are satisfied with the knowledge of it in the back of their head. But they all know.
And then the title of the essay comes from what, Rich? The end of it, where
The Ones Who Walk Away. So it somewhat ends with, you know, all of these people who will visit the child and ultimately do nothing. But there are a handful. There's a few people that see the child and at one day just walk away. They don't go home. They just leave Omelas. And where they're going, they have no idea. Does it even exist? Ursula doesn't know. But they ultimately refuse to take part in a society that is built upon the suffering of a child. So, ultimately, it says the whole point of it, I think there's two main parts. I think there's one central theme that is getting us to ask the question of, in our own society, is how can a moral just society exist with that prosperity being based on the suffering of others? How much are people willing to tolerate? What should be done about it? And can you walk away? Because I think this essay does add in two elements that make it a little easier to understand in a story, in a thought experiment. The people of Omelas both, in a way, have the power to change it. They have the power to stop the suffering of the child. And they also have the power to walk away, go somewhere else and not participate. And so, carry that, do you, in your own life, have the power to end the suffering of the people who provide you goods and provide you with the luxuries of life? Or do you have the ability to walk away? So, takes a simple concept that is very interesting and then gives individuals the ability to do these things, which I don't know, it's not as simple in the real world, but that's the point of a thought experiment.
Yeah, this touches on a lot of things, but main thing is utilitarianism.
Yep.
And again, is it, if you can put a number to something and say, if this affects the greater good for the most amount of people,
yep,
if that is true, is that moral? And this essay tackles almost a little bit in the, somewhat in the opposite direction of more virtue ethics, where it's, is it more moral to, even if one person's suffering, is it more moral because that suffering exists, you ought to leave this society? However, is that also a questionable action of, instead of just leaving, maybe you should do something about it, even if it would break this kind of utopia and joy?
Yeah.
What is the correct answer in the end? Well, it's supposed to make you think. It's meant to be a little bit, not just feed you this, but are you supposed to, what is your takeaway? Is it right to leave Omelas? Is it right to stay? Or is it right to help the child, but therefore helping the child leads
destroy
to the society? So it's a little bit of a trolley problem, but more complicated.
That's what I like about this essay, is often the trolley problem, I think it is the most basic, everyone understands moral ethical test, or, you know, it's the moral quandary that utilitarians can use, and it's probably the best example of utilitarianism. However, I think it is, that example is biased in favor of utilitarians. It's meant to bias you toward that, of like, of, for the most part, you can understand of, you know, pull a lever and, you know, change the track to kill one person instead of five, where the train is originally on. Generally speaking, most of the time, most people are going to go, yeah, pull the lever. Someone's going to die. It's better if it's one than five. Most people
understand that. One is your mother.
Yeah. But this is very much the trolley problem, but biased in the sake of virtue ethics rather than utilitarianism. And I think shines a harsher light on utilitarianism than virtue ethics. So I find it fills the same role, but biased in a different direction. That's why I quite like it.
And as an essay as well, so Le Guin, what I think she does better with her essays than books, with this, she sets up the thought experiment of going, hey, just take this as in this exists in this world, for example. Of one thing I liked early on, where she was describing happiness versus suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And how we view pain and how we view suffering. I want to see what you think about this, right? So she was saying how joyful people are, and that this isn't a bad thing, that people are just happy. She says, But to praise despair is to condemn delight. To embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else. We have almost lost hold. We can no longer describe happy man, nor make any celebration of joy. How can I tell you about the people of Omelas? They were not naive and happy children, though their children were, in fact, happy. They were mature, intelligent, passionate adults whose lives were not wretched. Oh, miracle. But I wish I could describe it better. I wish I could convince you. Omelas sounds, in my words, like a city in a fairy tale, long ago and far away, once upon a time. Perhaps it would be best if you imagine it as your own fancy bids, assuming it will rise to the occasion. For certainty, I cannot suit you all.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it feels like a response to us in The Dispossessed. Maybe she anticipated some of the problems with mainly utopian novels and ideals of saying, oh, that's unrealistic. In this essay, it's very much like, hey, the existence of utopia is not the point.
Yeah, it's like, talk and challenge the
whatever end. You gotta yeah. think in your head to just imagine and get past that. Like, the essay is not about, hey, is utopia possible? Hey, it's not about what would make a utopia. It's not about that. It's just imagine a place, the ultimate happiness, however they have to get there, which is interesting. Like, that's the premise you have to accept, move on.
Yeah.
From there, now we talk about what is that worth? What is the cost? And what are people willing to tolerate?
So, what did you think about this too? Because this is the quote right before that in the essay where it's talking about pain. Right. Mm-hmm. It says, the trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by pendants and sophisticates, sorry if I'm saying that wrong, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. Essentially what she's saying there is, like, hey, we have this tendency to go pain, suffering, that kind of stuff is what is the tortured artist. we had an episode on this where we were talking about, do you need to be depressed to write? Yeah. Is the tortured artist a thing? We see that so often. Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. Was he so tortured that that's how he made this compelling art? She's talking about that and saying, is pain, do you have to be that tortured artist? Is pain and suffering such a virtue? Or is more interesting, more compelling to be the tortured artist?
I could sympathize with Le Guin here. I think there is a tendency in many artists, and I mean, I guess just people in general, to put pain and suffering on a pedestal. Where ultimately it's an important aspect of the human condition because everyone suffers in a different type of way and like it's a part of life. So it is important to talk about. It's a great piece of art and it's a way that human beings can sympathize with each other over shared experiences. Perfectly valid. Like it's not like you should ignore suffering and pain in the human experience. But yeah, happiness is not silly. Happiness is not frivolous. It is equally valuable. To know suffering is to know happiness, and you need both to understand each other. That I don't know. It's like a roller coaster ride. If the peaks and valleys is what life is all about. So if you are very happy, it is often because it is in comparison to that you do know sadness and you know things can be worse. And that what's part of what makes you happy.
And she sets up almost this society as not being a less complex or that they're lesser people. This is a society that has all the good things that we would see as good. And it doesn't have what'd she say? It doesn't have the bomb. It doesn't have this. This is a utopia. The only caveat is that there is this one person suffering. It sets up this society that you can't say it's bad. It's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good. And what is worth it? What is worth it in our minds ethically to allow to happen in order to have the good, the utopia exist?
Well, she asks an important question that I don't know is entirely. It's a question you have to ask yourself, and if you think it's true,
yeah.
Does all good require some form of exploitation or suffering? Does the fact that I can eat a Costco hot dog for $1.99 mean that someone somewhere had to like be exploited, suffer in some type of way?
Like
is that a requirement?
More accurately, if I eat dairy, everybody around me suffers.
True.
Because
fundamental fact.
My day is ruined. It's over for everybody. But if you went and bought something minuscule, does that then lead to some sort of exploitation, right?
Yeah. Does happiness, does products, do goods require suffering to exist? And personally, I don't think that's universally true. But it also depends on your definition of specifically exploitation. I think suffering is a lot easier of like, ah, that blood diamond. Yeah, that's pretty, like, that's not exploitation. That's just pure suffering.
It has blood in it.
Like, blood in it. Like, those are a little clearer. It's a different thing of, like, where you're getting into the weeds is like, okay, well, due to economies of scale for this one item, this person was probably paid less than they maybe deserve. And it's like, okay, that's exploitation. But is that suffering? I don't know.
The opposite extreme would be like, how dare you fucking buy that apple at the farmer's market from Dave? You exploited Dave. Going, yeah. Well, it was a farmer's market. And I bought the apple. I wanted something organic. And you start freaking out. Like, can I buy apples?
So Le Guin does a great job with, I think at least acknowledging it. And then, like, the details are not important of, like, this society could have technology. It could have things like central heating, the subway, which I thought was interesting because I think, like, off, you know, the history of train tunnels has a lot of suffering in it. But moving on from that point, but like, it wouldn't have helicopters or the stock market. And so, like, right, there are some things that cause suffering and exploitation. There are other things that are just good for everybody, both the producer and the consumer. So I think that's a question you kind of have to ask yourself, and us as a society have to, and we get to determine the rules around things. Hey, that thing causes too much suffering to be produced. Ban it, or either don't ban it and let people decide. That's not for this discussion.
Well, what you're saying there with all the things she says that exist in society, she talks in general, but religion, drugs and alcohol, war, other things too. With war, for example, war doesn't exist. It's their sense of victory, surely. I'm quoting Le Guin here. The sense of victory, surely, the celebration of courage. But as we did without clergy, let us do without soldiers. The joy built upon successful slaughter is not the right kind of joy. It will not do. It is fearful and it is trivial. I guess she explained that because in the previous couple paragraphs, she was talking about religion and drugs and alcohol. Now, for example, with drugs and alcohol, she says that one thing I know there is none of in Omblas is guilt. But what else should there be? I thought at first there were no drugs, but that is puritanical. For those who like it, the faint insistent sweetness of Druze may perfume the ways of the city. Druze, which first brings a great lightness and brilliance in the minds and limbs, and after some hours a dreamy languor, and wonderful visions at last of the very arcane and inmost secrets of the universe, as well as exciting the pleasure of sex beyond all belief, and it is not habit-forming. For the modest tastes, I think there ought to be beer. What else belongs in this joyous city? Da-da-da.
Yeah, I mean, it is... It's just kind of going over these. I find this section fun in mainly going over the standard complaints of utopianism ideas and ultimately trivializing it. Of going like, Le Guin's just kind of going, hey, look, people focus too much on a utilitarian frame and idea. Like, okay, like, whatever, get over it. Get over like trying to create it and actually make a structure of it.
She basically says that there's the right amount of alcohol and stuff.
And like, hey, it's the right amount. Drugs does all the good stuff without any of the actual side effects, which is the reason why people are like, hey, don't do drugs. It's not about like, yeah, drugs can make you feel great, but also look at all these negative things that happen to you. That is why.
Erase the negatives. Like, it doesn't exist in Omelus.
Yeah.
Right.
What's your thoughts on the elimination of guilt? That guilt is a requirement.
I was not going to ask you that.
Oh, dang.
Okay.
Took it away from you.
Yes, because the whole thing about guilt, like guilt doesn't exist. I'm just, that whole portion of what does Le Guin set this utopia society as being, I'm just saying, okay, whatever the society is good in my, the thought experiment is that we all just should say, okay, this is the society we would all see as ideal. So the nuances of like, hey, is guilt like a necessary thing because
guilt is a function rather than an actual good. Yeah.
I know what Le Guin's saying in the term of like guilt about like guilt can be bad. There's bad kinds of guilt and there's good kinds of guilt. Like for example, if I punched you and later I feel guilty, that would be a good human emotion for me to go, oh, exceptions with that. But that would be good for me to be guilty later and then go, man, I really shouldn't have done that. That hurt the other person.
Yeah,
in the room, because guilt is you feel social, but in a utopia, she's talking about this utopia where
people don't even act in a way that would cause guilt. It's not that guilt, like people are doing awful things and don't feel guilty for it. That's a psychopath. It's that
violence doesn't exist.
Guilt literally has no purpose and doesn't occur because there's no reason to cause it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, the point she's making of. The end result of a utopia is there is no guilt.
Well, even the question that, like that.
That makes sense to me. I'm like, okay, fine. I understand that being a, like, if there's friction between people, there is often going to be guilt.
That I like the setup of this because it's, again, assume that all these things that we're asking questions about, oh, what about guilt? What about drugs, alcohol? All these kind of utopian ideals. Then she goes and asks, well, reader, do you believe, do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? By the way, I should mention, this is all happening during a festival in Omelissa. Do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. Like, she sets up all these things and going, wait, you probably still don't believe me that this is possible. Mm-hmm. I set up this, how can you have no guilt and no violence and no the perfect amount of alcohol, all these things that are so perfect? Well, does this make it more believable if I now zoom in and show you that this suffering exists? Because is it more natural for us to think that only these good things can exist. Only a society like this utopia can only exist if there is suffering, if there is still pain around. And then the question being asked at the end with leaving Omelas is, well, those people that are leaving Omelas, they don't know if there's something greater out there. They don't know if, who knows? The question is it more possible to get a more perfect society where 99.99999% of people are happy and just that one person suffering? Is there a society where 100% of things are utopia? The people that leave almost don't know, but they feel like they know what they're searching for something though. Is it? But it's begging the question.
It's the nature of virtue ethics of it's not about the end results that matter the most. It's about the means, and that yes, even it is better to live in a society with, you know, imperfect ends, but people are actually acting in virtuous means, and that is more important. And so I think that's the point, is that even if you could have paradise and only have one child suffer, some people would still walk away. And now you take yourself back. Would you walk away from Omelas? And in your own society of we live in both not a utopia, so not ultimate good, and there's more than one child suffering in the world today. And so it's on both ends. It's worse. It's maybe easier to walk away. You're not walking away from paradise. You're walking away from imperfect reality. And you're objecting to not just the suffering of one child, but the suffering of millions. So it's, I think that's the thought it's supposed to provoke and bring out of you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, What do you think you would do in this scenario? Like, would you walk away from Omelas? And do you think walking away in our own society is even possible?
In the thought experiment here, okay. Let me be realistic about it. What would I, if I was literally an Omelasian? That's the term we're using. If I was literally one of them, I think it would be difficult for anybody to leave. That's what makes the person who leaves here is seen as, hey, this person leaving. Look at this. Possibly noble decision they're making. Again, should they?
A very risky and brave decision.
Yeah, it is. They're giving up their utopia to search for something greater. Now, realistically, what would happen? Most people, hey, in practice, in the real world, if this is an analog to the real world, do we give up our luxuries, give up our comfort in order to potentially have a world where maybe we're less comfortable, but the society in general is better? That seems to be part of the question here.
Yeah.
And I mean, in practice, I'm not leaving my house. I'm not selling my car. And
we live in a society with the existence of charity, how taxes work. And most people are willing to sacrifice some luxuries for the betterment of other people. Like there is, to some degree, these ideas. And almost everyone is kind of on board for some degree of it. It's how much.
You gave a great example just before we were recorded because we're talking something off tangent. Mm-hmm. But you were talking about this example of if you were walking by a burning building.
Oh, yes.
And so do you want to give that example?
The argument against of like this kind of ultimate, the almost the antithesis of utilitarianism of if there is one person suffering, then no one should have luxuries type of deal. And that's, I believe, like Peter Singer has a essay that I hope we will go into later on the channel.
Oh, I want a quick caveat on that. We're gonna dive out of philosophy for the next month. I think I'm brains overloaded. I want give me simpleton stuff.
Well, yeah, I want more.
then we'll come back and do
action,
it.
Yeah. But yeah, we'll get back into it. But no, the thought idea, and I read this. I don't want to claim this is my own. It's a comment I saw from YouTube. It's probably taken from somewhere else. But it's the additional response. Mm-hmm. If you were walking by a burning building and you hear the cries of a child, you do have a moral duty and obligation to, if you are capable of saving the child and going in and helping, you have a duty to do so. And if you do not have the ability, you have the duty to actually call for help and call 911 and do something about it. However, there's that. And then just because there are burning buildings across the globe does not necessitate you having to burn down your own life to try and extinguish all the fires. Like there is, like, that's an extreme that ultimately is, it's fruitless. It's a fruitless extreme that's not going to really help it.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Anybody.
And you got that from a comment?
Yes.
You two comments have wisdom sometimes.
Sometimes I have it there. But yeah, it's that degree. Yeah. Between the two extremes of someone who's never willing to help anybody in their own life and is incredibly, you know, entirely selfish, and then the person who's beyond all measures is trying to put out the world's fires and is willing to destroy their own life to do so. There's some type of balance that everyone needs to find between those two, but both extremes are not particularly fruitful.
And then the question in this book, then, why it's more close to the example of walking by the burning building is you see the suffering child. You walk in, I'll give the quick paragraph so we can explain the reaction of the Amalassians, them. And so this is their reaction to seeing the suffering child. Here it is. Oh, there it is. Okay. It is too degraded and imbecile to know any real joy. It has been afraid, talking about the child, it has been afraid too long ever to be free of fear. Its habits are too uncouth for it to respond to humane treatment. Indeed, after so long, it would probably be wretched without walls about it to protect it, and darkness for its eyes and its own excrement to sit in. Their tears at the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality and to accept it. Theirs is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free. They know compassion. It is the existence of the child and their knowledge of its existence that makes possible the nobility of their architecture, the poignancy of their music, the profundity of their science. It is because of the child that they are so gentle with children. They know that if the wretched one were not there sniveling in the dark, the other one, the flute player at the festival, could make no joyful music as the young riders line up in their beauty for the race in the sunlight of the first morning of summer. Now, them saying that they know they're conscious, they see the suffering child, they also understand it is wrong in the suffering of the example of the burning building. So if you walk by and see this child suffering, it automatically gives you more of a moral obligation to do something that is right there, that you have actionable steps to do something about it. And
I think that does come down to it is power, is how much power do you have to affect change? Mm. And that how much responsibility, and this is a question I think maybe the essay doesn't intend to act, but it kind of does. How much responsibility does a member of society have for the collective ills and woes of it? So how much does an individual have responsibility for the collective? And at least in my personal thoughts, it's we have a duty of responsibility of moving from ourselves outward, and that the closer to the inner circle of ourselves is where we have more responsibility. Ultimately, I have most responsibility. I am most responsible for myself. That is the thing I am most responsible for, the things I should take care of, and like ultimately where everything else can possibly happen from. No one else is responsible for, like, chiefly responsible for me.
Your
like 100%. At one point.
A little less so now, but still there's a responsibility.
Yes. Yeah. But ultimately, I hold 100% responsibility for myself. And then as that goes out, it goes less than 100% as it further it goes. And that's not necessarily due to maybe potentially lack of empathy for people on the outside edges of the circle. It's more ability and power. And so you would ask, I think maybe a better question is like, as your power, as your ability improves, increases, your circles also increase them. And so that's at least my thoughts on it.
Yeah.
And that the reason why the people of Omelas maybe have more of a duty to walk away is they see the child. They know the child's there. They could actually alleviate the child's suffering and they choose not to. That's very different.
Now that's a question. Do you think it is more brave, more moral to leave or to help the child? But the implication is helping the child. Does that
you destroy everyone else's happiness? Yes, I get it. It's
so. What do you do, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think walking away is it's a courageous thing, but it's also it's the person who looks at the trolley problem and instead of pulling a lever one way or the other and deciding, decides to walk away from the lever and let five people die. Ultimate in saying like, I will be moral about this.
That is the virtue ethics thing to do of you are not touching the lever, so you are not being the means to the destruction of
what's more valuable, the fact that you as an individual were moral in that moment or, society's end result. And so, I mean, that's the whole debate between utilitarianism and virtue ethics.
We haven't read Dostoevsky yet, which we absolutely have to.
Mm-hmm.
But when Le Guin was asked about this, she said it wasn't inspired by Dostoevsky. She'd read him, but there was a similar, I think it's in Brothers Karamazov. I'm not exactly sure. I think it's in that, have not read it, but I was doing a little research where there's a scapegoat in that book or it's something that Dostoevsky wrote. People in the comments can correct me, but she was saying that she didn't exactly get it from him because it wasn't the thing that caught her mind. She got this idea more from William James, who wrote The Moral Philosopher and The Moral Life. But just to say that this kind of thought experiment she's talking about is something where there is a scapegoat, which is that suffering child that's been talked about before. And I think in Dostoevsky's case, again, not 100% sure, but it was more like Jesus's suffering was a core tenet to it. And I haven't read it yet, so I don't want to get all into something I haven't read. But this whole thought experiment, did it bring up any Christian themes for you of, or opposite in whichever direction of some one person suffering for the world's...
I can see it. I can see the opposite of that, of, the one individual that takes on the world's sins, like, and Le Guin going, like, some people will choose to walk away from that, and that it is not virtuous to have, one be the burden of everyone else's sins. I understand that. I guess you could take it that way if a Christian wanted to take this as an anti-Christian question that you're supposed to ponder. I don't necessarily think so, but what do you think?
I didn't think that myself. When I was looking into it, I saw that that was, and then I went immediately like, oh, that makes sense. That is a, whether intentional or not, like, okay, I can see the example of one person completely suffering for all of society, mm-hmm. and this being thematically similar to Jesus. And mm-hmm. then that's the question of it, whether she's commenting on that or not. This whole essay to me is, again, it's not, I don't have the answers to it. She's just provoking the questions of, here's something to think about. About this. Also, is this correct?
It's not a bad question for everyone to kind of ask themselves of, like, where do the things in my life come from? It's a good thing to, you know, the people that believe that all of their success comes from themselves. Like, oh, I'm a self-made person. I'm the reason I got here. I built myself up from nothing, and I got myself here by myself. Those kind of people, ultimately, like, there's an arrogance and ego to it of, you should realize how much other people have contributed to your success in life. And it's an important question of, like, even when you're consuming things, of, hey, what was required for me to eat an apple in my
from the farmer's market
apartment now. We were having that moment of I was ordering something on Amazon.
This was yesterday.
This was literally yesterday. My cat was, you know, pissing on my couch, and it literally went through a whole bottle of this special cleaner, and I'm like, shit, I need to order this thing. And
don't talk bad about Fig. Not on the channel.
I will.
Not acceptable.
A little piece of shit sometimes. Oh, is that
Coop? Go at him. What is that? What?
He's a little furball. Anyway, so I went online, found like a big jug of it that I know I'm gonna need.
A piss?
The cleaner.
Okay.
Like a gallon of this cleaner.
I was still thinking piss. Sorry. Like, why would you get a gallon of?
Anyway, I put in, and I was going out to order it, and by default, not as an option for extra money, default, same day shipping. It was 5 p.m. in the afternoon, and it was there at like 8 or 9 p.m. that same night. And that was the default. No extra charge for basically pet pee odor cleaner and a black light so I could actually search my carpet areas. And I got that within same day shipping, and I just had to think to myself of, something's wrong here.
That's too efficient.
That's too efficient. Someone had to suffer somewhere.
Bezos has to be behind this somehow.
Someone is on their 15-hour shift for this to work. I refuse to believe that this was done completely without any suffering or exploitation. Something had to happen. Those are thoughts I had.
You thought all this and went, let me order another one.
Let me do it again.
Oh, that was really convenient. I'm going to do two.
But no, it's a moment. But that is something important to reflect on and realize, like, to what degree are you willing to deprive yourself of goods and luxuries for the betterment of others and all that stuff. I just, there was a moment of going, something's wrong there. Something's wrong.
that happened literally when I showed up yesterday. I came over at 5:30, and you ordered it when I came there.
Yeah.
And it was here before I left.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
It's impressive, but also sparks a lot of questions. Horrific questions of how the fuck do you... Not only that, it's more in addition to just someone else on some 15-20 hour shift, the data mining, because ultimately there is little stuff about how often Amazon will use what you are browsing for to move. Even if you don't order something, they will order it for you in a sense and put it toward and move it toward a more convenient location. and like a more central location to, if like, hey, it's out of stock of your region, and so they'll move it there. So that way, if you do order it, which with their data mining capabilities, they know they'll like, oh, there's X percentage that they're going to actually order in the future. They move it close to you
area,
so they can actually ship it to you much faster. And so they use things like that. Just there's a bunch of fun stories. Well, horrifically fun, if that if your type of fun is twisted, of Amazon knowing that there's a article about like Amazon knowing that a woman was pregnant before the woman knew, or that, her parents or anyone else.
Yeah, I don't know if that was Amazon though. That it wasn't. I know
was
that
it Amazon.
No, it wasn't Amazon. It was some mail that came in, and not early internet, but that was something that was around early 2000s. I do know that. I just don't think it was Amazon. But it, was some, it happened though. There was some
at
type
old,
of data.
At older point, that data could predict that level of purchasing purchasing ability. Amazon is greater at board. They know everything. They know what you will buy before you buy it.
Basically, they knew that whichever company that was data, I don't know the exact story, but they knew that this woman was pregnant before she did
because
she was looking up symptoms of, she was feeling nauseating or
I don't
things
even think
related
it was that.
To, it wasn't that?
No, because she purchased things that like sweet goods, like basically just correlated purchases and things that she was looking up to other people that were pregnant.
Got it.
And like, it was a simple
ordering things that is like, oh,
hey,
well,
people that bought this also bought this.
Yeah.
It was sense. Basically that simple, but it wasn't as like, oh, they were, you know, woman looking up, you know, sick in the morning or, you know, period is late and they go, oh, of course, well, yeah, maybe she's pregnant. It was deeper. A person would not understand it looking at it, but a computer can see the pattern. And that's horrifying.
And that was,
yeah.
I want to say that happened in like 1903. So it's gotten worse since then. Wow.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. I do think the date was early 2000s, I think. But
I
can't
think
remember
you're
exactly.
Right.
But you sound right about the whole
thing. That is a example point that it's almost, the example point is almost irrelevant today. It is just ballooned far past that.
That tangent was off of, we were talking, we went back to Bezos,
Amazon suffering, how much, like,
you getting,
what
doing
goods,
one thing, what is the effect
it's,
of
it's probably
your
a good thing to look
luxuries.
At things. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know, it's why people should probably look into occasional, maybe don't center your entire life around it, because ultimately you only have the power of an individual, but to look into what you decide to spend your money on is an important conversation to have with yourself sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything wrong with that.
Now, with all of that said, what did you, the essay and this presentation, how it made you think, what did you think about the essay? Because this is our fourth Le Guin thing we've read, right? So what's your takeaways on this compared to what you've read of her before?
Ultimately, I really do like it. I think it's a better version of, it's a better, shorter version of Blood Over Brighthaven, ultimately, which is not a Le Guin book, but point still standing. I liked it for the antithesis of, not the antithesis, but the mirror image of the trolley problem. And even though these are things I've thought of before, it's not anything groundbreaking. It's definitely something that more people should read. If they haven't thought about these ideas, this is a very good way to introduce them to it. It's a more personal way, and especially told through a short story, you can connect with it rather than just giving someone a moral conundrum.
Yeah, it kind of sets up, hey, your little narrative, let me feed you in so you can believe in this. Yeah, five people on one track, one on the other is less human. This makes it a little bit more human.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so this also was written, I think, a year before The Dispossessed. We reviewed The Dispossessed like last month. Now, by the time this video is released, I do think her essays get across the points that her narratives are going for. So one of the major points of The Dispossessed, very light stuff, that's just thematic stuff if you haven't read it, but one of the points is looking at the society of AIO and seeing that, hey, there's a lot of people that are wealthy and they live off the bounties of a lot of suffering beneath them, this inequality that exists. And that's kind of projecting this larger problem of how much inequality do you need for it to be unacceptable? Is even just one person bad enough? Now in this society and the dispossessed, it's a lot on the bottom, a lot suffering. So it's, what is the scale to when you should leave the society and want change?
You also bring up questions, is all inequality exploitation, or, you know, does wealth itself require some type of exploitation? Does it mean, like, and I think in The Dispossessed, it's assuming yes, of inequality inherently means the exploitation of another, and that's a zero-sum game.
Profiteerians, and
I just ultimately disagree. Like, there can, the exploitation is a possibility, but not
default.
Not default, not exclusive. It's not a zero-sum game. Or at least it doesn't have to be, and it not always is. So, but that's an aside.
It's the whole thing we're talking about of the stupid examples, but Apple from Farmer's Market, or, wait, that got here in 3 hours. What blood diamonds did I just order?
Yeah, like, something happened. I want an explanation. I need more... I have questions that need answered.
When a service is so good, you're going, there's no way someone didn't die. there's blood on my hands.
There's blood on my hands because this is too good, too fast, too convenient. Something happened. Nefarious is going on.
When the average person like you or I starts to be treated like a king, you're going, who are the peasants working for me?
Oh, yeah.
You have to think about it in that way. Because
commenter will say, basically, the third world. We live in America. But that's another... argument.
Think of it that way, though, where a monarch who doesn't care about anything, things are just being, they're giving all the food, they're giving everything, all these luxuries, but all these people work. Man, we all again, in we're in America, we're also in,
there's a great deal of gratitude to have that I live personally I live a better life than kings did 100 years ago. So I mean, it's, hell, even 50 years ago, I lived better than most people. Like, the wealthiest of wealthy lived 50 years ago. The level of convenience and technology, it's amazing. And ultimately, that a lot of these benefits have been passed down to at least America's classification of poor.
I'd only disagree because back then they didn't have podcasts.
They were better.
So
those were better times. Yeah,
they,
I get it.
So in one way, we do have all this technology, and they couldn't access the world at their fingertips like we can. So how intense is that? How amazing is that we can do that?
It is the most powerful tool, but the most powerful tools are the most dangerous. So
with great power comes great responsibility, and every individual in the world has so much more power at their fingertips, and not everybody's responsible.
Most people aren't.
So that's weren't a lot of issues today because of that. Wow.
Like food. Food is so much more readily available today than ever before in history, and yet obesity.
Another great quandary of maybe almost related is the guy's name's Franz Haber, I believe, and he is the person that's both responsible for the chemicals behind creating the World War I poison gases that Germany used to kill a bunch of people, and a war crime using poison gas, as we would define it. And also Franz Haber.
Only a war crime the second time.
Well.
Canada.
But what did Canada do? What did they do?
Most of the Geneva Convention.
Oh, well, okay.
They've invented a lot of war crimes.
They're supposed to be nice.
Yeah, no.
Oh,
no.
Canada, oh, you dirty dogs.
They get to pretend like, oh, we're the good guys. Leave. Yeah, no. To them, it's Geneva suggestions.
That's a good line.
Not my own. I won't claim that one, but still.
But Franz Haber, who created that, also. Now, I'm going to get the science a little bit wrong. This is from my memory, but I believe extracted nitrogen from ammonia. No, extracted ammonia from nitrogen.
Okay.
Right? But basically led to the ability to have crops at insane rates of being able to propagate enough food to support societies that would lead to the billions of people that we have today. Like whatever, I think it was extracting ammonia from nitrogen or other way around. Sorry, I'm not great with anything. So that whole thing of where Franz Haber's both, one, responsible for the technology that allowed billions of people to be on Earth just because food being able to propagate that much, but also for poison gas that killed a bunch of people. So you go, wow. Was
the utilitarian goes, hey, probably on a scale of just number scale, Franz Haber probably has saved more lives than his technology has killed. Probably. I'm just going to assume that.
Fritz Haber. I knew I was getting something wrong. Yeah.
Thank you.
Fritz Haber. No, that was me. I was saying Franz. Yeah.
But probably that's true. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make Fritz Haber a particularly good guy for creating, poison gas to, kill the Allies and kill everyone in trenches. So, yeah.
What did we learn?
I wouldn't say he's a pretty stellar guy. I would not.
I would not plant
my flag there.
I will plant my flag in one way. Now, we've attacked the French a lot vis-a-vis Monte Cristo.
Of course.
Canada, you're next. I think we learned Canada sucks.
They get away with stuff. They get away in the history books of, like, they get glossed over. Same thing with Japan, often enough. Like, hey, look, Germany
Canada's
has
just our top hat, though.
Germany has gotten their due of, like, everyone has focused on Germany for good reasons of, like, hey, we get to look at their horror, suffering, and we don't never let them forget it. Good. I'm just saying that attention needs to be spread around. We've been focusing on the Germans.
No, it doesn't.
We can spare.
No, don't.
Like, 15% attention to the Japanese.
Okay, let's stop there.
That's just, I'm just like.
Then no more, no further, look, right? We're stopping there.
In Canada.
No, I just didn't want you to go to the third axis.
Look, let's I stop. Would,
just
I
keep,
would say.
Leave Italy alone is
look,
all I'm saying.
I would say that. Like, oh yeah, we should focus on the evils of Italy.
I already know.
But also, they were just not.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. We weren't even.
They weren't effective enough to be evil.
Our fascism wasn't good enough for you?
No. Like, yeah, it's bad, but is it on the levels of Germany and Japan? No, not at all. It's not even close. Like, that, just the weighted scales.
Well, now I'm kind of offended. What do you mean? We killed a lot of people.
Yeah, not like the Japanese. You would say the Japanese did such horrific things that often the Nazis were horrified and heard news about.
Yes, I do know this. I do.
My God, the baby murders is just insane. They invented new ways. But
Italy, like, we did a lot of war crimes. Look at us go. We did. What should I root for?
I don't know the war crimes that Italy has committed.
That's so sad.
I don't even know.
We couldn't even do evil right.
I know.
What the hell's wrong with
that? That's probably
them?
A very us. Short history book.
God damn. Wow.
I love how other people have, like, a competition to see, like, who's better. And we're just like, who's worse? Who's the most evil? Like, yeah, everyone kind of sucks. Who's the most?
It's worse to be, like, insignificant. If you're going to be in a war, at least be the bad guy. Not the worst of the bad, you know?
The Canadians, they're just killing it. The fact that they can, basically define so many of our war crimes and yet still get to be one of the good guys and just be like,
I'm just going to take your word for this. I didn't know that.
I'll show you a list. It's fun. It's fun to look at. You get to look at them differently afterward.
Okay. I had no idea. Okay. Well, this is the essay, The Ones Who Walk Away From Omelas. Your takeaway, you liked it overall?
I liked it. This is a good one.
Yeah.
Use this instead of the trolley problem.
Instead of the dispossessed.
Also that.
Now, there's more to the dispossessed. It's just, I really do think Le Guin is just an essayist who's like, let me make a narrative as well that's more focused on just, she makes long essays in books.
Yeah. Oh, well. All right.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody. See you next episode.